Today's case will be on, today's Taisho will be on case 20 in the Mumon Kan, the Gate of No Barrier. Case 20 is entitled, The Man of Great Strength. Shogen Osho asked, why is it that a man of great strength does not lift his legs? He also said, it is not with the tongue that he speaks. Mumon's comment, it must be said that Shogen shows us all of his stomach and intestines. But alas, no one can appreciate him. And even if someone could appreciate him, let him come to me and I'll beat him. Why? If you want to find pure gold, you must see it through the fire. Mumon's verse, lifting his leg, he kicks up the scented ocean. Lowering his head, he looks down on the fourth jhana heaven. There is no space vast enough for his body. Now, somebody write the last line here. Thank you very much for coming to practice this morning on this beautiful fall morning. This week I had a terrible week and a wonderful sit. And sometimes those two things go together. Let me explain. Part of the program that I administer is an ESL program, a for-profit ESL program. And we offer courses in English as a second language to non-registered students, that is, people who are not regular Rutgers students. They come from overseas and take English language classes. And sometimes they come individually, or they live in the area. So we have people who come here to the New York area to learn English, and they register at our school, our ESL school. And they pay quite a bit of money for instruction that we give them, and we try to give them really good instruction. So, you know, these are people who often are very well educated and they have very high standards. So we have to do a good job. We have to deliver a good education to them. They will know if we're not doing a good job because they've been to excellent universities in Asia. And they have very high expectations of us. So, you know, we have a pretty good program. We have had seen our business grow and grow over the last, say, 10 years. And we also have such a good reputation that the governments overseas send their students to us. So, we have contracts with the Japanese Ministry of Culture and with some universities in China. We have contracts with the government in Turkey, with the education department in Turkey, and with the Saudis, even, the Saudi government. We have an educational contract with Brazil, with their Ministry of Technology. So, you know, all of these, over the years, we've been offering these courses for individual students, and now we're offering packages that we are arranging with the governments. And all of this is actually makes a fair amount of money, for Rutgers. Last year we made about $3.5 million, which is a lot of money, actually. I know that in the sciences sometimes that doesn't seem like much, but in the humanities that's a fortune. And Rutgers is cutting back on all this support for departments, so we have this income stream that we depend on. It actually pays people's salaries. And as our language school has grown, more and more people are employed by it, and we have really excellent people working for us. So now you know this is the story, right? We have this school, this language school, that has grown and grown over 10 years. And we have been more and more successful. We used to make $0, and now we make about $3.5 a year gross. Now it's pretty good. That's not the point of the Taisho, however. That's just the backstory. Now, you know, our English program, our English school, is really good, but it's an institution that relies on human beings. And human beings have very positive aspects and, as you know, negative aspects. So this institution was growing and growing, but at the same time, lots of tensions were building up inside of it. And at the end of the summer, basically, there was like a civil war in our language school. This might, if you work in an institution, this might sound familiar. It doesn't have to be academic. It can be business. There was like a civil war. Unbelievable. And years of bitterness and unhappiness exploded. So I am in charge of this. You know, the person who runs this reports to me. So I had to go in and try to mediate. And it was a mess. So I'm trying to make sure that no lasting damage is done to anyone or by anyone. You know, I'm trying to put you in this corner, you in this corner, you know, put your weapons down, you know. Very difficult. So anyway, years and years of hostility and unexpressed grievances and so on and so on. This is a human situation. By the way, don't think this doesn't happen in Zen temples, because it does. You know, Zen temples are not full of enlightened people. They're full of people who are trying to wake up. And they're just as confused as everybody else, you know. So Zen temples can be madhouses too, believe me. So if you're trying to get away from a human confusion, good luck. Because, you know, you'll carry it with you. You know, even if you live in a cave, you'll be having an argument with yourself pretty soon. So these things are part of being human, part of being a sentient being. And we can't try to escape them. We have to work with these energies, these destructive energies. This is very important. You know, even if you could go and live in a cave, you know, you would still have to deal with these conflicts in yourself. So whether there are conflicts between people or conflicts within people, this is the material we have to work with in our lives. We can't really run away from it, because we can't grow without it. So anyway, all of this is going on, and it's chaos, and I have pushed different groups. I actually have an injunction. You cannot speak to him, she cannot speak to you. It's like a court injunction, right? You are forbidden to speak to him, you know. Any communication must go through me, you know. This kind of thing, you know. And of course, both people are running, you know, both sides are running each other down, you know. So this is just could drive you, you know, anyway. Something in all of this conflict, this is so typical of humans, right? In all of this conflict, nobody's paying attention to a very important detail. Our status, our renewal with Homeland Security. Yes? So we bring students in here from all over the world, and we have a person who's trained to process the student visas, so that they can go to our school. And we have to have security clearance with the Homeland Security people. One person got a notification 3 months ago saying in 4 months, by the end of 4 months, you have to have refiled. So this is all going on, right? And on Monday, I get a letter from the, you know, basically from Homeland Security saying, you have 30 days or we're going to cut you off. So this was like, I was going to have a heart attack when I read this, right? Because, you know, basically, we're out of business if this happens, right? And all the people who work in this institution will be out of work, and we can kiss our 3.5 million goodbye. And the people, and by the way, that pays for salaries in the English department. So, you know, when I read this, you know, first of all, when I read it, I thought, okay, we can deal with this. But, you know, then as I began to think about it more and more, I began to get more and more worried, right? And so, you know, on Tuesday morning, on Monday night, I didn't get very good sleep. You know, I was really worried. This is a disaster in the making. And I thought of all the people who would be hurt, and of course, you know, I'm trying to straighten it out, and this side is blaming this side. It was their responsibility. No, it was their responsibility, blah, 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 you know. So I'm not getting any help, in other words. And this is like going to fall apart if we don't do something. So Monday night, you know, I went to bed, and I'm sort of tossing and turning in my bed. And I got up and I thought, on Tuesday, I'll solve this. And then I just got back into the Civil War. So, you know, on Tuesday night, we have the sit at Princeton. And I went to the sit, you know, just feeling like, really very, very frightened. And I sat down on the cushion and I just threw myself into my sit with, you know, it was like for dear life. For dear life. And I had a fantastic sit. I was just in deep mood, in that deep emptiness the whole time. And when it was over, you know, I felt absolutely like wonderful, serene, calm. You know, this worked, it works. You know, it's so wonderful. And it was, I just felt like, you know, no matter what happens, I can deal with this. No matter what happens, I can deal with this. And it's true that as the week went on, you know, I got back into difficult places. And, you know, I get back on the cushion and you get into this other state of mind, which is this mushin, which we call mushin. And in that state, you know, you're really imperturbable. You know, it's absolutely the case, you know, that the worst possible things can happen, and things go on, life goes on, you know. In that state, you realize, you know, there's a bigger coherence to things. Now, you know, you can ask me if we don't get our Homeland Security clearance, and you can ask me if there's still a bigger coherence to things. But if we don't get it, I'll have to do a lot of zazen, you know. But there will be. There is such a thing. And being able to access this bigger mind in a crisis is not just a handy resource. You know, it's really crucial, I think, for having a life worth living, You know, I think a lot of the problems in this institution, this language school, come from people not being able to step out of the small self. You know, we're all striving to be valued, and there's nothing wrong with that. You know, we're all striving to be valued, to be respected, to be loved. This is an incredibly powerful motivation. And we're all trying to create a self that's worthy of respect and worthy of love, you know. And we're all, this is a very important human motivation, and it's not something we can put aside. You know, this is part of who we are. You know, we're trying to create a self worthy of respect and love. You know, But it becomes a difficult project, you know, because you know, life doesn't always support our efforts. So it's very often the case that, you know, our society, our way of life, doesn't really dignify everybody. Doesn't dignify everybody, you know. So you know, just being a certain way means it's much harder for you to create a self worthy of love and respect than it might be for somebody else. Some people walk into a room and all eyes are on them, and everybody comes up to them and wants to be their friend. And it might be because they're famous, and it might be because they're rich, and they may have a lot of charisma. And then, you know, some people walk into a room and nobody notices them, you know. Or maybe even people respond unkindly. You know, so you know, we can't really control. We're trying to create a self that people will love and respect, but we can't really control the situation. You know, so sometimes we're in competition with other people who are trying to win our respect. So, I have an assistant. I have an assistant who's a very capable woman, and I have another colleague who's also a very capable woman, and they don't like each other. And I think they see each other as rivals. I do. And so, you know, we have to staff, we have to put teachers in, give teachers teaching assignments. You know, so we have, in the fall, we have 370 sections, believe it or not. That's like huge. And we have 250 people who teach those sections. And we have to match the teacher with the class time. So, basically, my assistant was responsible for this job, which used to be done by my colleague. So my assistant does it now, my colleague used to do it. And what my colleague, when I gave it, took it from my colleague and gave it to my assistant, my colleague said, "Oh, she'll never be able to do this properly." So she's trying to do it properly, you know, and get information from my colleague. My assistant and my colleague are not working well together, you know, because basically they both want to show that only they can do this job. And they actually won't, you know, their email communications create a lot of friction because, you know, I'll get a call from my colleague and she'll say, "Oh, she's just not doing it right." And then I'll get a call from my assistant and my assistant will say, "She's just not giving me the information I need, see." And you think, what is this? What is causing this trouble? Why can't we all just get along? But they're both in a kind of desperate struggle to be loved and respected, and they're in each other's way. See, this is so common. You know, so, you know, I try to be affirming. You know, I try to say, you know, I say to my assistant, "You know, you are doing a fantastic job." I say to my colleague, "I'm so glad to be working with you," and I mean it. But, you know, these frictions arise because people are constantly trying to be worthy of love and respect, you know. You see this in so many ways. In my job, you know, in my other job, like as an English person, you know, every once in a while, I will read an article written by somebody I know, and they'll be attacking somebody else I know. And when you see your friends attacking each other in print, it's really a difficult situation, right? And I myself have been attacked in print. I remember years ago, I wrote this article that was a little bit controversial in this journal in my field. And then about 2 years later, I saw an article by a friend of mine. And her name is... Min Lu. And I got the journal, I saw, "Oh, Min Lu has an article in here. I wonder what it's about." And I opened it up, and it's an attack on me, right? This really happened, you know? And then she went up, it was not only about me, but the first two pages were like this incredible attack on me, you know? That really hurt my feelings, you know? Later, she apologized to me, I'm happy to say. But, you know, it just felt terrible, you know. Now, you know, why does she do it? Partly, maybe she really, I mean, yeah, true, she disagrees with me. You know, she really does disagree with me. But you know, on the other hand, it could have been done a different way. I mean, I think part of it is that she's struggling for love and respect. And of course, I felt she was taking away my love and respect, you know. So this is, you know, this is very complicated. This creates a lot of tension in human relationships. We're all trying to be loved and respected, and we're all competing for some imaginary person's love and respect. And so this makes it difficult for us to get along, you know. And then, you know, the other thing, another thing that causes us to feel threatened, you know, or feel like we're not getting the love and respect we need is when things don't go the way we want, you know. So, about a year ago, I wrote an article, and I sent it off to the same journal where I was attacked years ago. And I thought they would love this journal, and they didn't. This article, and they didn't like it at all. In fact, the editor wrote back and said it was she didn't like it. She spoke about it in rather unkind language. You know, so this bothered me a lot, actually. You know, because I had written this piece, I put a lot of energy, like 6 months of work into it, a lot of research, and she dismissed it in an unkindly way. And that really hurt my feelings, you know. I was trying to accomplish something that would have given me more respect, self-respect, and it would have made me feel more loved and respected, and she torpedoed that, you know. And, you know, when this happens, we can, if we're not very, if we don't have very strong egos, and I don't exactly know what that means, you know, we can feel very off balance, you know, we can feel off balance. You know, so this is like, these are the human dynamics, you know, and so we often, you know, sometimes we do things that are not necessarily our best, we're not always acting from the best place, because we're feeling desperate, or we're feeling threatened, you know, and unloved. And, you know, we will do things that are not necessarily very good to feel loved and to feel respected. And if we're threatened, we can behave very badly, as I've seen many times. So, you know, this is sort of like the human comedy, if you want to put it that way, the human world, to a degree. And it's really where we live, you know, basically one person will get a promotion and another person won't. You know, you'll go for a job interview and you're charming and intelligent and somebody else gets the job. This happens all the time. Or, you know, you're doing a first-rate job. You're doing a first-rate job and you get laid off. This happens all the time, you know. And again, you know, when this happens, you know, we blame ourselves. Even though the circumstances are, we know the circumstances. You know, I remember reading years ago that during the Great Depression, one out of every three adult men was out of work because the world economy had collapsed. But, you know, a psychologist who did research during this period with people who had lost their jobs found that they tended to blame themselves. Isn't that interesting? So the economy had collapsed. The whole companies folded. And when people were out of work, when men were out of work, they thought, well, it's really my fault. Yeah, this is so human. You know, we want to believe that if we were just worthy enough, we wouldn't have lost our job. But so many decisions have nothing to do with your worthiness, your personal worthiness. You know? You might be doing a great job and you still get fired because there's a merger or something like that. So, you know, if we live on this scale, if we live, this is like living on a certain scale. This is like an everyday life scale. If we live on this scale, it's almost a formula for unhappiness. It's like a formula for unhappiness in my view. Because, you know, basically we're struggling to be recognized and respected and loved, and things, there's always going to be things that are unfair or you know, people who don't appreciate us. And, you know, we can go through life being hurt, feeling blocked, blocked, thwarted, disappointed, and people can get very bitter about this. This koan is why does a man of great strength, why can't he or why doesn't he lift his leg? So, you know, there's different ways of approaching this koan, but one way to think about it is, look, if you're a person of great strength, you should be able to lift your leg. You know, you should be able to lift your leg. But why can't he? Why can't this man of great strength lift his leg? You know, and I think we sometimes feel like a man or woman of great strength who's just not able to lift his leg or her leg. You know, this sense of being stuck or paralyzed, you know, I'm never going to get the love and respect I deserve or that I desperately need, you know. So many people are in this situation. And you know you can do it. You know, there's so many times in life we just know we can do it. We know we can do it, but we don't get the chance. Or things just break wrong. You know, they just break wrong for us. You know, this is absolutely part of life. And we don't like to look at this part of life. We like to think about our being in control of our lives, right? This is something we like to believe. We're in control of our lives. But if you think about how much of your life has never been in your control, it's a little bit frightening. It's a little bit frightening. So you know, you could say, well, I've pretty much been in control of my life. And then somebody could say, well, did you choose to be born in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania? No. Did you choose to go to Yorkwood Elementary School in Baltimore and get beaten up by Bobby Westbrook? No, I didn't. Did you choose to go to Lakewood Intermediate School? No, I didn't, and so on. And you probably didn't choose your profession. What usually happens is we go to school, we tend to play to our strengths, you know? So you realize, oh, I'm pretty good at this. Maybe I'm pretty good at this. I like it. I'm pretty good at it. Maybe I'll go this way. You know, if you're honest about it, there's a lot in life that we can't control. I mean, people in the middle of their married lives sometimes go through a crisis because, you know, they suddenly realize, I could have married somebody else. You know, this happens to, I think, to be honest with you, I think this happens to everybody who's married. You know, you fall in love, you think, this is the only person for me. And then, you know, maybe 7 years into your marriage, you suddenly realize, you know, I could have married somebody else. Yeah. And by the way, your spouse is having that same thought on the same day, you know. Saying, I could have married somebody else, right? So you know, you realize, gee, this could have been somebody else. It just, you know, my wife was, and I were working at a restaurant. I was in the American Southwest, backpacking with a friend of mine. I went out there and I worked in a restaurant for 6 months with my friend Larry so we could go backpacking after college. And my wife was finishing up at University of New Mexico. She was working as a waitress there. And I just turned in my resignation, and Larry and I were heading up into Colorado to backpack. And on the last night at the restaurant, I said to this woman who became my wife, hey, I said, do you want to go out for a drink? And she said, no. You know, I'd rather not speculate about why, but she said, no. So then I thought, okay, fine. And then I started walking out, and I came back, and I said, are you sure? And she said, oh, okay. Honestly, that actually happened. What if she had said no again, right? My life would be totally different, right? You know, so really, this is so much how life is. We have a fantasy of controlling things, but very few things are actually in our control. I was talking yesterday afternoon to somebody who's involved in the environmental movement, and she gets up every day. You know, this whole global warming thing is very depressing, right? You know. Recently, we've gone up above 400 parts per million now of CO2. And everybody, all the people who know are saying this is really, like, terrible, right? And nothing's happening. Nobody's making any changes. So my friend is getting up every day, and she's going door to door. She said, this helps me to deal with my sadness, you know, over this situation. And I think that's a good idea. She's trying to get people to sign up to some program. But, you know, we all feel a little bit as we're confronting this event like we want to be able to control the situation, but we can't. We're like the man of great strength who can't lift his leg. That feeling, right? I know this can be done, but it's not getting done. I know I can do it, but I'm not allowed to do it, you know, this sort of feeling. So, you know, living in this place is like a formula for unhappiness. It's a formula for unhappiness. And you know, basically, there's, you know, one message of Zen is that there's another way to approach things, right? And there's another way to approach things. The great Zen master Dogen, has a wonderful, three wonderful sentences. He says, to practice Zen is to study the self. So that makes sense, right? You know, if we practice Zen, we're studying the self. Then he said, to study the self is to forget the self. And then his third sentence is, to forget the self is to become one with all things. One with all things. So, to practice Zen is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to become one with all things. This is like the essence of Buddhism, not just Zen. You know. So, you know, one of the most basic lessons of Zen, one of the most basic assumptions of Zen practice, is that we can control our own mental processing, that we can take responsibility for our minds. You know, so some of us have addiction problems. Some of us have problems with compulsive behavior. Some of us have anger issues. Some of us are deeply neurotic. And I'm raising my hand, you can't see it. You know, we all have our things, right? Our things that you know, cause us suffering. And when we decide we're going to practice Zen, we do something very important. You know, very important. We say, I am taking responsibility for my own mind, and that puts you in the minority on planet Earth. You know, most people don't want to take that responsibility. They don't want to do that. So I think people who just begin to sit down on a cushion and do Zen are really admirable people. They've already made a very important ethical decision. And it's really an ethical decision. They said, I am going to take control, or take responsibility, I should say, for my own mental processing. You know, I'm not going to be angry all the time. I'm not going to be fearful all the time. I'm not going to respond from my neurotic place, you know. I'm going to take responsibility. So this is really, I think, really admirable. People who follow this path are really admirable people, in my opinion. So step one is saying, look, what is my mind like? You know, I'm going to sit down on the cushion, and when you sit down on the cushion, you see all of this stuff, all the craziness, all the fear, all the anger. You know, this happens to everybody. You know, people imagine, you know, many, many people come here to practice Zen or try it out. And sometimes it's the physical dimension that's the challenge, but usually it's not really the physical dimension. It's this facing the self. This is a real challenge. You know, people think, I'll do Zen, I'll sit down and I'll bliss out. And you know, sometimes the first couple of sits really are very blissy, you know, very nice. But then, you know, you sit down on this on the cushion, and there is your fear, or there is your anger, or there is your insecurity, right? And you know, there it's right there. You know, so step one in Zen practice is facing this, taking responsibility for our own minds. OK, you know, and step, but you know, if you do this, you sit down on the cushion, you're working with the breath, you know, you begin to encounter your own obstacles, and you just keep coming back to the breath, you know, something happens. Something sooner or later, something happens to you. You know, you're sitting on the cushion, and you're maybe thinking about the $3.5 million that might be lost, right? And you're worried and you're fearful and you think, oh my gosh, everybody's going to think I'm an idiot. How did I allow this to happen? Blah, blah, blah. And then it's like, you know, you step beyond that place and suddenly it's this emptiness, but also this great openness, eventually this great sense of openness and spaciousness, you know? And it's like being able to step back from all of this chaos and all of this fear, and or maybe I should say it's like being able to step above it all, right? Above, like looking down. It's like, you know, another way to put it is like a bigger view. Bigger view. You know, you think, if I don't get that promotion, my life is ruined. Right? If I don't get that promotion, my life is ruined, you know? And you really fear. You know, it's like, I will be unworthy if I don't get this promotion. You know, I can't imagine how I will deal with it. And you sit down on the cushion and you watch your breath and you watch your breath and it's like you get into a bigger place. You know, the small self, you know, that small self perspective disappears and you have like a bigger vista. You know, in deep samadhi, the self is no longer at the center of your consciousness. It's like your mind opens up. And instead of being constantly centered on the self, you have a kind of awareness which isn't anchored in the self at all. It's like a kind of free-floating awareness. And in this state, you know, by the way, things can be experienced very differently. You know, people feel like they're floating off the cushion or their body has become hollow. The other night, somebody came up after the sit and said, my God, these dates are so delicious. I don't even like dried fruit, but this is so good. You know, this is samadhi mind. So when the mind is no longer anchored in the small self with all of its routines, its familiar routines, you know, you're now in this very open place and everything can be very fresh, very new. And this, I love this state, right? This is a beautiful state, samadhi, this openness, this beautiful openness. Consciousness no longer anchored in the small self. So, you know, the small self is angry, 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 self, you know, worried, 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 and then you get into this place and it just opens up. And that small self sort of falls away, you know. And this is so liberating, right? I mean, people in other times have understood this other self much better than we do because modern people, our society is based on being able to make life plans, right? You make life plans. We believe in planning. We believe in control. It's very big for us. But, you know, people in other civilizations haven't had this same obsession. You know, they've been wiser, I think, you know. A farmer. You think about a farmer, you know. You plow your field, you do everything right. You plow the field, you get the best seed, you go through your seeds and you make sure they're okay, and you put them in the ground, you pat, you know, whatever you have to do, you pat them in. You know. You fertilize, you water, you go out and weed in the hot sun. You know, you do everything right and, you know, it might not work out. You know, it might not work out. And you know, I think people who live that way, they see very starkly that you can't control things, right? And you could go crazy with that uncertainty. But I think people in other cultures, you know, have developed a different psychology. They've discovered this open place, and they live there. You know, live more of their life there. You know, Zen is very heavily influenced by Chinese thinking. And Chinese people have this idea of the Tao, you know, the Tao. There's a kind of a bigger harmony to things. You can't see it necessarily on the micro level, You know, but there's a kind of harmony to things. There's a direction to things, right? And so, you know, if you live on the small self, you're going to be miserable. You've got to live on this bigger, this larger consciousness, in this larger framework, or you'll sort of be driven crazy, right? You know, Chuanzi, who was a follower of Lao Tzu, the Taoist, great Taoist thinker, said, you know, basically, people who live in the small self will be ground to pieces on the lathe of heaven. That's what he said. You know, it's like if you've ever seen a person turning a lathe, like a chair leg on a lathe. You know, life is like that blade. It's constantly cutting us into shapes and forms. And he said, if you can't get outside of your small self, you'll be torn to pieces on the lathe of heaven. And so, you know, Taoism was all about not living in this little self, but harmonizing yourself with the bigger perspective. And this very much goes along with Buddhism. You know, Zen is very much about this, living in this samadhi mind, or drawing our energy from this samadhi mind. So, you know, to practice Zen is to study the self, to sit down and encounter our baggage. But then, you know, step two is deep samadhi, where, you know, to practice Zen is to study the self. To study the self is forget the self. You know, when you enter deep samadhi, you forget the self. And now there's this tremendous sense of freedom, right? You know, tremendous sense of freedom. And a sense of like ability to act in the world freely without all of this neurotic self second guessing, and really in this state, you know, consequences don't matter. They don't matter. I'm an English teacher, and I'm sure most people in here have read Hamlet. You know, you've read Hamlet. And Hamlet is all about this deeply neurotic guy who's always self-second-guessing himself. And at the end, of the story, Hamlet sort of gets it together. He has like a Zen moment, actually. And he says, you know, I'm going to act because, you know, there's a bigger perspective, there's a bigger drama going on, and, you know, I'm just going to act and I'm going to trust the drama. You know, I'm going to trust this process. And he said, I can't pull the lines out right now, but he just basically says, you know, heaven has its own purposes. And we just have to, adjust ourselves and go along with the flow. Go with the flow, basically. Shakespeare didn't say that. But that's the idea. Go with the flow. Just go with the flow. Hamlet actually gets killed, interestingly. But you know, it doesn't matter for him anymore. Because he's in that bigger mind. It's the purpose of action is really not necessarily to be successful or to be a failure, right? When you're in that bigger mind, it's just being part of the unfolding of things. This is so important. This is what Zazen is all about. You know, you come in and you sit down on the cushion and you think, I'm going to have a really good sit, and you don't. You know, you don't sometimes. And it all goes badly, and you can sit there in great negativity. You can say, I'll never do this again. This Zen is a scam, you know. But, you know, sometimes we let go, we give up, and we say, I'm going to harmonize myself with this bigger perspective, this openness. You know, the heaven has its own purpose, you know, so to speak. The Tao called it, you know, the Taoist said, the way of heaven, right? The mandate of heaven, the mandate of heaven, the will of heaven, the will of the sky, basically, is how the Chinese describe it. I'll go with the will of the sky. You know, so in Zen, we go with the will of the sky, you know. We're just going to trust the universe, right? And this is incredibly liberating, and consequences don't matter so much. Look, you know, I think my friend going door to door to try to stop global warming is probably, I don't know, is she going to be successful? I hope so. Hope so. But, you know, she's doing the right thing even if she's not successful. Even if this, if we go to the boiling point, you know, how are we going to face that event? How are we going to face it? We might not be able to stop it. So how are we going to go into oblivion, you know, if that's where we're going? You know, angry, bitter, hateful, fighting to the end. You know, humans could end that way, right? In a big fight. Like my ESL program. That's how we could go down. It could happen. But we have a nobler nature. You know, we have a Buddha nature. You know, it may not be controllable, but we can go into the future with compassion, love, patience, generosity. You know, that would be good, right? No matter what happens, we can have an open heart. No matter what happens, we can have an open heart. If we've got that, we've got everything. Even if we get obliterated, right? Even if we don't succeed, if we have an open heart and we trust, we've won. We've already won. See. To practice Zen is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to become one with all things. See, becoming one with the great Tao, with the will of the sky. See, this is our way in Zen too. Not just the Taoist way, this is our way. So, you know, life is uncontrollable. That is the great fact that we repress as fully as we can, you know. And when we sit down on the cushion, you know, we are faced with our fantasies of control. We blame ourselves because the world economy has collapsed, that idea. But, you know, there's a better way to live life, this spacious mushin. And we learn this lesson again and again whenever we sit down on the cushion, you know. You encounter the inability to control. And then the only way out of that situation is to enter this bigger mind. And we call it big mind, bigger mind. And that, in that state, by the way, you're opening your conscious mind up and your unconscious mind, and you're fusing them, even though you might not feel that way. You know, that's what's really happening. When you have that state of elation that comes from giving up, it's like conscious mind and unconscious mind come together, like matching, like a coin that's been broken in two, and the matching halves come together. And when you unconscious mind and conscious mind come together, you have this sense of elation or trust, right? And then you can go forward into whatever is happening next. Shogen Osho. Osho means priest. Shogen Osho asked, why is it that a man of great strength cannot lift his leg? And he also said, it is not his tongue that he speaks with. See, he doesn't speak. The universe speaks through him. See, the universe speaks through us. Wuwon's comment, it must be said that Shogen shows us all his stomach and intestines. But alas, no one can appreciate him. And even if someone could appreciate him, let him come to me and I'll beat him severely. In other words, judgments about good and bad, right and wrong, success or failure are illusion from the Zen standpoint. Shows you're not in the big mind. Why? If you want to find pure gold, you must see it through fire. That's Zen, right? You know, we sit down on the cushion and we encounter our crap, yes? And also, you know, that takes courage. We face that and we work through it. You know, you have pain in your legs. You want to get up and walk away. But if you don't do it, you know, interestingly, if you have pain in your legs, you know, if you're in agony, move your legs. But, you know, if you have pain, a little pain in your legs and you don't move, sometimes you drop down into this bigger consciousness. So Zen is all about, you know, Zen is all about not walking away from the fire, but walking right through the fire. It's not everybody's, you know, way of living, but... Mumon's verse. Lifting his leg, he kicks up the scented ocean. Lowering his head, he looks down on the fourth jhana heaven. There is no space vast enough for his body. When we go into deep mushin, just keep doing it. Your body becomes the world. The world becomes your body. To practice Zen is to forget the self. Is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to become one with all things. When you sit in deep mushin and you hear a bird sing and you feel like it's coming from you, or you taste that date or that tea and it feels like heavenly ambrosia, this is the experiencing the world as your body. So there is no space vast enough for his body. Now, someone write the last line here. So that's your job, to write the last line.